And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. We've got all kinds of transitions, travels, and other happenings to discuss with you today. Glenn is just back from Comic-Con, so we will talk about conventions and other gatherings of teeming humanity. I am about to leave town to meet with the television critics, so we will talk about this fall in television and what we think is coming up and what we're excited about. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, owing to some social engagement that our friend Trey Graham seems to think he has the right to engage in, we are without Trey this week, but fortunately that means that we can spend one more week with our fearless producer, Jess Gittner.
Woo! Yay! Woo.
Jess Gittner, what do you do at NPR?
For a short time longer, I'm a producer at Morning Edition.
Well, if you didn't hear the show last week, you may not have heard this already, but this is Jess's last week with us, so we're very happy to have her on the microphone this week. It's going to be a little bit of a scramble the next couple weeks. I'll be out of town, and I'm sure you'll get to hear some of your favorite subs of the past, present, and future. And Glenn, so you're just back from San Diego.
I am.
You were at Comic-Con.
I certainly was.
You were on a floor full of teeming humanity.
130,000 geeks.
130,000.
And publicists.
Many of whom were widened by the chainmail.
Right, exactly.
Well, yeah, or the powdered Toast Man costume.
Oh, the powdered Toast Man costume.
That was good.
High watermark.
So, Glenn, you are a person who I don't think of as wanting to be around the largest number of sweating enthusiastic strangers you can possibly get your mitts on.
Yeah.
And yet you went to Comic-Con.
I did. It was an experiment, really. I mean, I have been hearing about this thing all my life, and I got a chance to cover it for NPR, and so I leapt at it. And I thought I would be able to play to some of my psychological backhand and and maybe get over myself a little bit. We've talked on this show about my attitude toward crowds and the things that make them up. What are they called? People. Don't care for either one. But I decided I'd go, and I would certainly take this opportunity to meet a lot of the people I've only corresponded with over Twitter. And, you know, this is not an after-school special. This is not a Hallmark movie. People don't change. So I'd like to come back and say, and now I love, you know what I love? People. You know what I love is
crowds.
Love.
Yeah.
Because it's all about connection, man.
Yeah.
But, you know, people don't change like that. And I'm still the same guy. I did try and open up to myself. It is such a huge, multifaceted thing that I'm still processing it. There's no one simple reaction to it. I don't think you can come away from something this huge and have a simple reaction to it. So I'm very grateful for the diaries I'm doing on the Monkey See blog, which helped me kind of process it.
They've been great.
Thanks. I just I thought it was really, really great. It was a singular place. It is a place of unbridled and unguarded enthusiasms. It is a place where a lot of the connective tissue you have to establish between people is already there. Emotional connective tissue, the sort of the references you make with other people are the same. It is a surprising place, something around every corner. I do still feel, I went into this thinking I don't get autographs. We talked about this before.
Right.
I don't get the autograph thing. I don't understand why I would necessarily want
you,
it to you
also don't
myself.
Get. You also don't get thanking the artist.
Well, I don't get talking to the artist. I mean, this is the thing. I don't understand what I would say to somebody who produced a work that I love because I have the work and the work is what I respond to. And what I would say to the person would, you know, I don't know what I'd say. Maggie, your mother, has a very different response to
yes,
this.
She
and
does.
She was chiding me gently, and not so gently, about how I need to be a better fan. Basically, she was saying, you know, if you love the work, you would love talking to the people who produced it. And all you have to do, if you really love the work, is just go up to them and, you know, ask them a question about it. And I don't feel that way. I still don't. I mean, what would I get from them except biographical detail, which I don't care about, or authorial intent, which I care even less about, which doesn't matter to me at all. And what it is I think it might be, this just occurs to me now, it might be simple arrogance, because it might just be me saying, you know, I don't think of myself, fundamentally, I don't think of myself as a fan. I do think of myself as a critic.
Mm.
So I feel I need to maintain, I just don't want to reach out to these people and hang with them. It's not that they would hang out with me, but but I felt completely different. And what I think I got from the conference, and this is what I want to talk about a little bit, is I got energized by actually finally meeting people I've dealt with over Twitter, over email, colleagues, let's say. People who talk about pop culture, people who talk about books, people who talk about comics.
People who are on podcasts.
Right, whose work I have admired, whose work I like, and we have corresponded, but we've never met, and this was a chance to actually meet them, and it was great.
So can you talk about some of those meetings?
Sure, but I there's so many, I don't want to like leave anybody out.
No, of course, of course. It's a partial sampling.
Humble brag.
Can you give a partial sampling of how those, some of those encounters went?
Well, sure. The way it happens at a conference like this is that you just stumble upon people, and they see your name tag, and they say, oh, you're X, and I say, you're Y, and we spend some time together. And it just happens over breakfast. I met Heidi McDonald, who runs The Beat, which is a very influential comic book blog about the comic book industry. I just met a bunch of people that I've sort of been following for a long time. That is energizing. That fills me with something. I also, we arranged a pop culture happy hour meetup, and that was great because, again, those people already know me, and they're dealing with my big bag of bullcrap already, so I don't have to, like, get over that. If they want to come to the meetup, they know who I am. And it was a really great time with a bunch of people, a bunch of nerds talking about nerds. I kept asking people questions about this book I'm writing, about the rise of nerd culture, why do you think it happened? I got all kinds of different answers. It was really a great time. The panels were cool. Some were good, some were bad. And, you know, every so often you turn a corner at this giant conference. And, for example, there was a little girl. You turn a corner, you see this little girl with cerebral palsy in a wheelchair who is posing with this dude in a costume, this giant cyborg, like, inside this giant mech suit. And she's looking up at him and saying, like, there's an affinity between us. And it is, if this was planned by a publicist, it would be gross and mawkish and sentimental. But it just stops you. It stops you in your tracks because it just happens. Because this floor is so huge that moments like that happen. So that's what I got out of it. I mean, I still have a lot to process, and I'm still working through it. But it's really
sounds
about
traumatic.
it
really sounds traumatic. Like I'm thinking as a producer, like pulling out these clips and putting them alongside some dramatic movie. That's what I'm trying to think of.
It's about the people, Jessica. Guess what I'm saying?
Well, I have that experience every year when I go to South by Southwest.
Right.
And I feel like South by Southwest and the San Diego Comic-Con have a lot in common in that they started as large enough events and ballooned to the point where everything that you say the convention is about, you have to add the word logistics.
Right.
And where they become gigantically overwhelming, overpowering, you are missing something at every moment, mix of very enthusiastic fans and people who are there to pump up the brand.
Right.
And so you have these interminable conversations about, you know, what's this festival about? You know, 25 years ago, people were saying, man, this convention used to be so cool.
Right.
And as it gets, you know, bigger and bigger and bigger and sort of becomes almost this city unto itself, it's interesting because, you know, we've all been, I mean, I'm assuming we've all been to conventions of varying and festivals mm-hmm. of varying size, but there's a big difference between small gatherings of like-minded nerds and gigantic gatherings of less like-minded nerds.
Yeah. This is where I would mention, when I first started writing on the internet, one of the first things that I was writing was recaps. When I worked at Television Without Pity, I wrote recaps of The Amazing Race. And this was the fall of 2001. Right. So this was a long time ago. The fall of that year, obviously, was very dominated by September 11th. And I had been writing these recaps, and I had gotten to know some of the people who were on the show via email. It was all very odd. And there was, at the same time, some of the people who posted on our forums said, you know, if some of us went together to a bar to watch the finale, do you think somebody could organize a bunch of us to get together?
And kind of they reserve would reserve a room.
And they would let us turn on the TV.
Right.
And so we talked about it, and they agreed that they would do it. And I decided to fly out and go and say hello to them and meet them. And as it happened, partly because I was in touch with people on the show and because the contestants that year were a very close-knit group. That was the first season of this show. They all showed up. They just start walking in, the people from the show, which the fans in the bar did not know was going to happen. It was entirely organic. Mm-hmm. It felt so cool and fun. And from then on, it became this thing we did at the end of every season. And I made friends at those parties that I'm still friends with.
Oh, yeah.
But as time went on, it became sort of more and more of an official thing,
yeah.
A big thing. They would rent
CBS would essentially send the cast.
They would
the
rent
show
a whole bar, and it became something where the network,
became aware that this was a great event for the show and that it really kind of pumped up the fandom. And it was this special kind of fan-run thing that lots of shows didn't have. So they started not just sending them over, but basically making them go so that everybody would be there. But it went from something where everybody was there because they wanted to be there to something where people would attend, fans demanding and expecting that they would get FaceTime with everybody from the show. Mm-hmm. And people who were on the show would show up and not want to be there and kind of act like, why do I have to be around all these dorks from the internet? And I continued to have a lot of fun with individual people. But the event as a whole never meant quite as much to me as an event mm-hmm. as it did when it was really this genuinely kind of scrappy thing that right. happened, partly because that fall of 2001, there were a lot of bars in New York that were really struggling. Right. And so this bar in New York was incredibly hospitable to us, the place that we had the first one, because they were trying to get people to come and be out and go to bars and stuff like that. So I think anything can go from being a really organic, fan-driven thing to a kind of top-down,
right.
publicity-driven thing, and it does change the nature of it. Jess, are you a convention person, fan gathering person?
I am not. The things I've gone to, I've gone to sort of day-long or 2-day-long music festivals. Any longer than that, I'm just tired. And so I maybe could get into something like Comic-Con, because I'm assuming at times it involves chairs. But something like South by Southwest totally overwhelms me thinking about it. So as far as festivals, I would go to consume the thing. That has to be the main thing that I have to do. If it's to meet like-minded people, that's what the internet is for me.
In terms of breaking the ice.
Of course.
And, you know, I've gone to, like, you know, people who read this website, you know, meet at this bar in New York, and it was just incredibly awkward. There wasn't really a focal point to connect on, and mm-hmm. something like I See the Amazing Race, you know, you're focused on a thing, you could talk about that thing.
Right.
But if that thing is not super clear and mm-hmm. what's bringing you together is larger, that umbrella is not necessarily going to capture similar people.
Well, and one of the advantages of those Amazing Race parties, which I went to a couple of them myself, as it gets bigger, you have the disadvantage of it's getting bigger, it's getting more official. But you also have, and I guess it's a mixed blessing, people who have hung out at this party season after season season. So there's a little bit of a family reunion
quality
to it.
Absolutely, there was.
For better and for worse. Yeah.
And, you could say that.
And so, you know, I've been going to South by Southwest. This past year was my 17th straight year going. And it does get to the point where I'm very old. you have your people that you hang out with every time you go. I mean, I'm going to the Newport Folk Festival this weekend, and there's like a bunch of my sort of Newport-y hangout friends. And that's part of the joy of it. That's part of why you look forward to going. And one of the advantages of the Newport Folk Festival is that it's contained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's contained by the location. They have to have it in the same spot because it's a historic spot. It's a perfect, beautiful spot. They can add stages within it to a point. And you have a cap on the number of people who can go. They put the tickets up for sale, you know, 6 months ago. They sell out instantly.
Right.
And that's how many people are there. That's how... And so it doesn't necessarily get to the point like that South by Southwest
did. It doesn't sprawl the same way.
It doesn't sprawl. Like at South by Southwest this year and for the last couple of years, there is, in the middle of a parking lot, I believe it is a 54-foot tall model of a Doritos vending machine.
Right. Yeah.
And I saw a singer I love named Haley Bonner was playing within this monstrosity of corporate idiocy.
Right.
And it was indicative of something, even though I am not one of those people who's like, oh man, it used to be about the music. Because you know what? It's always been about a certain amount of that.
Right.
And speaking of the monstrosity, I mean, Jess Gittner, if you get overwhelmed by South by Southwest, I would wave you off Comic-Con because it is so huge. And I did hit a wall, not of physical exhaustion, though I did hit that. A psychic exhaustion. I mean, on Saturday, after being there since Wednesday evening, I was sitting in the bar writing up the diary and realizing and getting this feeling of anxiety, because if you're sitting in a bar writing about the thing, you're not experiencing the thing.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Luckily, there was all kinds of weird stuff happening immediately around me, so I could start writing about that. But there is this feeling of, especially at this thing, that there's so much you're missing. That there's, if you go to one panel, you're missing this other panel. If you let it get to you, it really can. And I was talking to Maggie about this, and she was saying, yes, 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 there's always more. Excitedly.
And that's my mother.
And I was like, that's exactly the problem.
Yeah.
Let it be. This is sufficient. That should be. That is my motto. Yeah. That is enough, please. That'll do, pig. No more. This is. Let's stop now.
Yeah. Yeah.
No more now.
I think there's a lot to be said for containment, and yeah, and the fact that as they sprawl out, they become logisticon.
Right.
You know, logisticon 13 right. is not fun.
One of the things I've sort of been to two big or big-ish film festivals, one of which is bigger than the other. The one that's actually not as big is South by Southwest. Mm-hmm. The one that's bigger is Toronto. The biggest difference between those two festivals as an experience is that although there are other venues at Toronto, the vast majority of it takes place at just a couple places.
Yeah.
And they're very close together. You can fan out and go to other places. There are other programs, but the vast majority of your film going can be within essentially one gigantic multiplex. At South by Southwest, it's all over Austin,
yep,
which has a certain charm to it. You get to see different theaters. You get to see, you know, the big theater where I saw Cabin in the Woods versus the little Alamo Draft House that I right. got in the habit of heading down to. And I would just kind of go to what was there because I liked
the
theater.
Because you like the venue, yeah.
And that has its charm as well. But the Toronto one didn't wear me out as much
yeah.
because there was not nearly the same amount of logistics.
I have often said of South by Southwest, you could, if you time it out just right, if you time out any given day just right, you can spend all your time seeing things you want to see, or you can spend all your time trying to get to something you want to see.
Right.
Yep, yep.
And it's each day is a crapshoot, and you kind of wake up in the yep. morning like, this could either be the best day ever. And I've had best day ever type days there. And I have had days that were almost entirely a wash. Like I would see music eventually, but that timing just isn't always there. And it's, I go to South by Southwest for work, but if I go as a civilian, and I did go entirely as a civilian one year, paid my own way and just did everything on my own dime, not working for anybody. And it costs a lot
it
of
costs a
money.
Lot. Yeah, it costs a lot.
And so the thing yeah. with South by Southwest is it's more of like a place you have to be.
Yeah.
And it can get to the point where you're in a rat maze just getting poked with sticks.
And I'm pretty sure every year there are people who say to me, like, it would be so fun if you were at Comic-Con. And I'm always like, it might not be fun for the people who care for my mental health.
Right. Well, there are ways to manage it. There's certainly ways. I mean, somebody gave me the advice of every day in the middle of the day, just walk outside the convention mm-hmm. center and just go for a walk along the water, which is a very smart thing to do. I did get in a line almost as soon as I got there because being in a line is part of the Comic-Con experience
right,
in a very
right.
essential way.
I really liked what you wrote about that, though.
That was great.
That it was part of like meeting people and...
right, that's exactly what it's about. I mean, and there is in that environment such politeness, such
that's unique maybe to
it is
Comic-Con.
That's the thing, because I do think it has yeah. something to do with nerds.
It depends.
We're very sensitive about our personal space, and when it gets invaded, it's an infraction, and it's addressed because people turn to you and sincerely apologize. There is, and also the level of unbridled enthusiasm is
yeah.
in this
that's so
closed
key.
Place, mm-hmm. and it doesn't, you know, returning to the streets of Washington, D.C., which is a kind of it's a conservative town in style and demeanor. I'm talking about just how people present
right,
themselves.
Sure, sure,
sure.
I started missing Comic-Con as soon as I walked out in the street and just saw everybody looking exactly alike.
A lot less cosplay.
So, Stephen, you were talking about lines and
yeah.
how you could spend the whole time in lines. And Glenn, you were alone largely, except sometimes with Maggie. I'm wondering, like, do you need a buddy to sort of withstand the torture of these festivals and conventions? Because often, you know, I go to a lot of movies, I go to a lot of concerts. I often go to them
by
alone.
By yourself, yeah.
And so I can't imagine them dragging out over the course of a day mm-hmm. and being alone.
You know, I go to enough of those things like South by Southwest. What you want is a kind of a few buddies where you have the sort of relationship that is not fraught enough where you can just say, later. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll meet up later. We'll figure it out. I mean,
you don't want anybody you feel responsible for.
Right. You don't want anybody you feel responsible for, but you want people who are fun to go to shows with, who have somewhat common tastes, whose mm-hmm. tastes may draw you to something you would not have otherwise seen. Mm-hmm. I think it's nice to have, like, a mellow buddy where it kind of comes and goes.
Yeah. I had a bit of experience. Actually, Meg and I didn't actually spend that much time on the convention floor together. Mm-hmm. She was kind of my Virgil, and then she kind of sent me on my way. But my friend JC was there for the first full day, and we walked around, and that was really good because he could point out things, and I could point out things. And then he left, and I was there alone for the next 2 days. And I got the sense that it's a different experience because I saw everything that first day with JC, but I sort of felt everything when he wasn't around because mm-hmm. I could hear people talking. I could pick up on the emotions of the people, and these emotions were not complex. These emotions were, this is awesome. Look, I'm so happy right now. Like people saying that over and over of all ages and all sizes and all races. I mean, it was just all this happiness, which is one of the reasons I had to excuse myself after a while. a little too much happiness. But, I mean, you're sensitized to something if you're just kind of looking in a different way. Mm.
Well, I'm sure that plenty of you out there, including those of you who met Glenn and those of you who did not, have experience at conventions. We'd love to hear about it. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. And, you know, speaking of big events, I am headed out of town. As those of you who have been reading the blog and or listening to the podcast for a while know, this is the time of year when I go out to Television Critics Association Press Tour. Now, what happens at Press Tour is that the networks and PBS and everybody, and now Netflix and Hulu,
right. mm-hmm.
bring in their new stuff and some of their old stuff. For example, because Breaking Bad is ending, there's going to be a Breaking Bad panel to show to critics and to let critics ask questions of cast and producers. And of course, the networks want to persuade you that everything that they have is going to be awesome, despite the fact that, particularly on the broadcast networks, most of it, statistically speaking, will be canceled.
Right.
So this is where I am headed. And I wanted to give you guys a little bit of a briefing mm-hmm. on what we're looking at over the next few months in television. So the comedy landscape to me this fall is dominated largely by the sort of, let's build a comedy around this person. Mm. It used to be that that's how it was, and it was all stand-ups. Mm. Now it's people who have been on successful TV shows.
Okay, like Michael J. Fox.
Of the past, like Michael J. Fox. Mm. I have not finished watching all the screeners yet, so this is not a comparison of everything to everything else. But the Michael J. Fox show is actually one of the best screeners that I've watched, and that's an NBC show. They have managed to start doing business with Michael J. Fox again. They obviously had him on Family Ties for many years, and then he was over on ABC with Spin City, and now he is back on NBC. And in this show, he plays a local news guy who basically has Parkinson's, right. as Michael J. Fox does. And so the guy goes away from work for a while, and this story picks up when he comes back to work. And it not only does it have Michael J. Fox in it, but it also has Wendell Pierce, who was the Bunk on The Wire, mm-hmm. and it has Betsy Brandt, who is Skyler's sister on Breaking Bad, and mm-hmm. this is a completely Ooh. Different part for her. And she's really funny and charming. It's got a bunch of people in it who are good and funny, and it's well constructed. And what they've done is clearly somebody has decided we are going to say it's okay to make jokes about his limitations and sure. the things he's trying to deal with and his disease. And there is a little bit of kind of warm and fuzzy heart to it. But at the same time, there are some jokes in this where I was like, I'm impressed that they decided they were going to let fly with that joke. I liked that.
Does that seem like a Thursday at 8:30 kind of? Like, where do you see it fitting in?
I think it fits in pretty well with the stuff they're doing single camera-wise, Parks and Rec. And it would have gone really well with 30 Rock. Mm-hmm. It feels like kind of that kind of show. It's less absurdist than 30 Rock. Right. It's got more the feel of Parks and Rec. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed it. I did not enjoy the Sean Hayes show. Mm-hmm. Oh, boy. The Sean Hayes show.
And it's called The Sean Hayes show.
It is. And at least the last time I saw a title, it was. It is about a gay dad with a kid. And it feels like the sitcom rhythms of the 80s or early 90s. Mm. There's kind of a weird retro thing going on in television right now where, like, Under the Dome feels to me like something that could have been a Stephen King miniseries in, you know, 1992.
Right.
And NBC just started doing this series, Camp, which feels a lot like the kind of TV movies of summer that used to have, you know, Mark Harmon and, you know, like many years ago, kind of those and Charlotte Ray as the cafeteria. I mean, it's...
Is it because it's comfort food? Like, because of that familiarity?
I don't know. I wonder whether, and to me, I see some of this in the network schedules. I think the networks have tried and failed to do what cable is doing. And now they're wondering if what they ought to do is try to go back and do what they are good at doing.
Right.
And what they have traditionally found success doing. Because it's still true that the networks, if you look at successful network shows, like look at something like The Good Wife, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The Good Wife is a pretty standard, traditional network kind of show. It's a lawyer show.
You wouldn't say it pushes the envelope, right?
No, it's a good show. And I think they're trying to figure out how, you know, they want to make stuff that is good, that people like. They want to get their reputations back a little bit away from cable, which has kind of started sucking up all the awards
and now it's getting farther and farther away from them as new platforms emerge.
Exactly. And I feel like there's a little bit of a retreat back to, like, let's try to make the stuff that we have traditionally been good at.
Right.
Kind of ordinary, you know, fun comedy. Let's not try to be FX comedy.
Right.
Let's not try to be necessarily dirty, dangerous comedy. Let's kind of try to make a sitcom with Michael J. Fox that works. And The Sean Hayes Show is a multicam show, meaning multicamera shows are the ones like where you hear the audience laughing and it looks different. It doesn't have that 30 Rock look. It has that Friends look. Mm-hmm. So The Sean Hayes Show is a multicam. They're kind of playing around with where they want to wind up. But one of the things that's happening is I think networks are trying to figure out, is the future single camera or do you want to try to figure out the next, like, Big Bang Theory? For a while, it was all going single camera. And
right.
Now there's a little bit more like, maybe we were moving a little too fast and we should go back and try to find something that's going to be more traditional. I like Chuck Lorre has yet another show on CBS. This one stars Anna Faris as a woman with she was a young mother. So now she's like a woman in her 30s with a teenage daughter. And her mother is played by Allison Janney. And so it has some promise that the pilot is uneven. It feels like a Chuck Lorre show. It's not a big groundbreaker.
Right.
But I enjoyed it okay. Probably the biggest drama in terms of hype, especially coming off of Comic-Con, is the Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. thing that Joss Whedon is doing, at least the pilot. But I think is not going to run that show on an ongoing basis because he has other projects.
Yeah, he might.
But that's the one for which they are bringing back Coulson.
Yeah.
They are bringing back Coulson.
Clark Gregg.
Clark Gregg. And he's going to kind of be the center of this show, which is the operations of part of the Avengers universe.
Have you seen a screener?
They have not released a screener yet. They're going to show it to us at Press Tour. I know they showed it at Comic-Con.
They did, and I talked to several people who saw it and ate it up with a spoon. They were kind of predisposed to the Joss Whedon thing.
That's the thing. You kind of have to wait and see, you know, how it strikes people other than kind of Joss Whedon people who are notoriously really loyal and really enthusiastic.
Right. I asked them specifically if it seemed, you know, how television action can seem small.
Right.
Can seem shooting for action and spectacle and kind of making it seem...
And if they saw it on a big screen, we'll still kind of have to see whether that's the case because you can't really tell. Because I remember when they showed the American Horror Story pilot to critics, they showed it to us in a movie theater, and I just was in love with it. And when I started watching the show on TV, I fell away from it a little bit, and it's partly just because I loved it as a big, scary show. Wow.
It is so scary.
Yeah.
Yep.
And in a theater, it was unbelievably fantastic.
I can't imagine it.
Well, it's not like it's not a decorated show outside of that.
Absolutely. But for me, it was extra effective. So if you're thinking about that stuff about action looking small in television, then we'll still have to kind of see how it plays on a TV.
Mm-hmm.
But they are going to screen it at TCA. So when I get back from Press Tour, I hopefully will have seen it.
Mm-hmm.
There's always new stuff, you know, interesting stuff coming from PBS. They've got American Masters. I don't know if any of you are fans of the American Masters series, but they do these documentaries about artists. They've done Bob Dylan, and they did David Geffen recently, and there was a little bit of talk of, like, is that an artist? He's mostly a producer and kind of a, you know, can you be an artistic megalomaniac or whatever he's supposed to be? But now they're doing Billie Jean King. So this is their first sports figure that they've done on American Masters. So they're going to be presenting that. There is a bunch of other stuff coming up. There is always new sci-fi kind of grand period costume stuff going on Stars. And
yeah, you don't mean sci-fi.
I was going to say, I was going to ask about Sharknado 2 if you were going to get an early.
Right. I don't mean sci-fi like S-Y-F-Y. I'm sure that they also have an entire spate of new, I don't know, head of a chicken, body of a...
entirely new NATOs.
Once they make the Chicktopus movie that we
it's
crave.
It's true. Make the Chicktopus. It's not any sillier than Arachnoquake, I'm going to tell you right now, which they absolutely made.
One thing that I find interesting about your trips to TCA is, as much as you go to these panels and you see, you know, you preview a lot of these shows and you're there with critics, and again, it's what, like we were talking about with conventions, you see a lot of the same people you know and everything, but I always find it really interesting when you are brought to the set of a show that you already know that would not seem to be making any kind of news. Like when you were brought to the set of The Price is Right.
That was great.
You were drawn, which, you know, is really all I want.
I know. I know.
Or you were brought to the Big Brother house.
Yes. Big Brother house is one of the most interesting things that I've done at TCA. And I believe they're going there again this year. I'll have to see whether I want to walk through that house again. It's actually kind
it feels more racist this year.
It's kind of creepy, but it was creepy in a way that was interesting. Yeah, the Big Brother house is where I was walking around, and like, if you watch Big Brother, you know, they're in that house all day, but they also have the yard when they can't have them in the house.
Right.
So all they did was put the people who were living in the house out in the yard temporarily.
Like you put the dog out.
While they walked critics through. So you're walking through this place where people like just were, and you're looking on the stove at the dishes they haven't done. And there's this one part where Andy Dehnart, who writes Reality Blurred, goes, "Look at that." And I look down, and sticking out of this duffel bag are these flame red hair extensions, which are very identifiable as belonging to this one girl. And we're like looking at it thinking like, those are her extensions. We're looking at her extensions. It's so creepy.
Found a way to invade these people's lives more.
Absolutely. And I felt very weird about it. I felt like, why are we in here? Like, these people don't know that we're in here going, like, looking at your open suitcase.
I don't know that they're fiercely private.
Yeah.
No. that was what made that a little bit interesting, was the feeling of you feel like you're invading their privacy, and yet, obviously, they seem to have sacrificed.
So walk us through a typical day. I mean, you wake up, you go down. It's just one giant room with a lot of long tables that you sit at. Do you sit at the same place every day? Are there the sharks and the jets? Are there the popular critics and the less popular critics and the nerd critics and the heathers? And how does it work?
I have a sort of group of people that I typically sit with. And it's typically the same people. And we typically sit in the same place in the ballroom every time. So, yes,
and
I
you
will.
Don't, like, it just cycles through. Like, all these shows cycle through. You stay in the same chair, right?
Well, right. So you get down there. Usually there's breakfast served by somebody or other. If it's NBC, they serve you cold bagels. Whatever.
Nobody knows the trouble.
Believe me when I tell you, I have a good time at this thing. This is not actually complaining. I appreciate the cold bagels, NBC. I really do. So
nobody knows my sorrow.
I know how it sounds. I'm just describing. You have breakfast, and then you go in and you sit at the tables, and there's usually some like black eyed peas on the PA. You're like, I got a feeling, and you're sitting there like, and you're waiting, and they're doing little sizzle reels, and sometimes little shots from different shows are playing on these big screens that are next to the stage. And then they announce, you know, they're going to be starting, and then the room goes dark, usually. And then, like, there's a clip, and they show a clip. And then at the end, there's a crowd of people in the back, and they work for the network, and they applaud.
No.
But the critics don't applaud, because that's not, we don't do that. We're not there to applaud.
Yeah.
So what'll happen is there'll be this, like, far away smattering, like, just, like, in the back. From, like, all the PAs and people who the network brought in.
Who do they think they're fooling?
Well, no, it's they're enthusiastic. They like their shows, so they will.
So it's not there to like make the critics think.
Oh,
that,
I thought it was like a laugh track. Or
no, I don't think so. I think they understand. So then they clap, and then the lights come up, and there's a group of actors and producers and people like that sitting on
like
the stage.
Suddenly, like
yeah. The lights come up, and they're usually
a big flash. Yeah.
Usually,
and a puff
while
of smoke
the usually
then...
while the clips are playing,
y'all ready
the
for this?
People. Usually while the clips are playing, the people are being placed, right? Mm-hmm. So then the lights come up and it's very quiet.
Yeah, that's
and they're all just sitting there.
It's gotta be weird.
Like this. And then somebody often gives a little intro and then they throw it open for questions. And the killer, there are networks that think that the worst thing that can happen to your show in terms of omens is, you know, that everybody acts like they don't like it.
Right.
Or that everybody acts like they think it's offensive or something like that. The worst thing that happens are the shows where just nobody has a question.
Yeah.
And just nobody says anything.
Like, it's about a family of oddballs.
Yeah. And you just kind of sit there and nobody asks anything. And there are a couple of critics in the room who tend to take it upon themselves.
To take pity.
To take pity on the show and try to come up with some questions. And there is Alan Sepinwall, who is one of my press tour pals, has talked in the past about something that they called the Rule of Jay. And there was a guy, his name is Jay, and the network...
I follow you so far.
And the network people all knew that anytime he asked more than 7 questions in a panel, the show was going to fail because it meant no one cared because he would jump in and try to ask questions. So what would happen is the pages and the network people would try to end the session before he asked the seventh question because they knew that all the rest of the critics in the room would be like, oh, that one's gone, you know, that one violent. So they would actually, according to Alan, now this could be urban legend. I've never actually seen this happen. But so that's essentially a typical panel. And then the panels run all day.
Did you fall in love with the script?
Yes. Turns out I did fall in love with the script.
If you want to know what it's like, I once wrote a very bizarre post, which I will link to, about if your appendectomy was presented as a show at press tour, how like the doctor and the doctor would be there and the nurse and you, the patient, and everyone would talk about like, well, I really wanted to work with this doctor because I've seen his past work and stuff like that. It's a very kooky. I was really, really
high.
I was really, really high on the Beverly Hilton at that time. Anyway, so that's TCA. And then at the night, there's like cocktail parties and stuff like that. It's like, come out at poolside with the cast of Franklin and Bash. And then you go out there.
Would I?
Decide whether you want to have a mimosa and try to talk to Breckenmeyer. And that's kind of what it's like for 2.5 weeks.
What are the big themes in TV? Like, I remember there was like a couple of years ago, half the shows were about manhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how all of us men are struggling to hold on to manhood.
The masculinity crisis seems to have passed.
Thank goodness.
In television.
I wasn't sure I was going to survive.
Let the record show that Stephen just clutched the pearls when he heard that the masculinity
crisis. I did kind of make
crisis.
A pearl-clutching gesture, didn't I?
Yeah. Okay. I don't see any big, like, single themes. I think there's some effort to come up with something soapy like Scandal.
Right.
Generally, themes come from something
imitation.
That worked in the
past. No, but I think you're onto something there. With like, there are things that FX can do, that IFC can do, that just can't be done on network broadcast,
absolutely,
network television anymore.
Absolutely.
So they're scaling back. That makes sense to me. I mean,
absolutely. It makes sense to me, too. And a lot of us are like, look, I don't want all of my good dramas to be about people getting shot in the face. I've written about this before.
Yeah.
Like, I welcome good shows. Like, people really like Parenthood and stuff like that. Like, there can be other things that are good besides these really super intense
face shooting,
violent face shooting cable dramas, anti-hero cable dramas. Anyway, so that's TCA, and I will be covering it pretty much every day while I'm out there for the next couple weeks. And I will see you guys, back here after the next 2 Mondays when I'm sure that you will bring various wonderful subs in.
We will.
To pretend to be me. And Stephen will host and everything will be wonderful.
Yep.
And that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Jess Gittner, my pal, my producer, my auxiliary brain.
A few things. I want to thank the lovely listeners for wishing me well on Twitter, and in particular two people, Emily Scharf and Chris Collins, who sent me emails. So thank you for sending me good luck emails. Now, it is said somewhere that there's 3 things that are really stressful: death, something else, and moving. So I've been quite stressed. And so I've tried to move away from the music I typically listen to, which is mellow, wallowy, you know,
dour,
mopey stuff. Mm-hmm. So who is making me happy? Dan Deacon. Dan Deacon's remix of Miley Cyrus's We Can't Stop. It's okay. So I think the song, he is doing Miley Cyrus a service here by making her words unintelligible. I'm not a lyrics person, so I don't mind that, you know, whatever she's saying is now muddled and confusing. Basically, this is a remix from a collection of 37 remixes of this song. So they're all this song remixed, some of them in comedic ways. But this one is basically him. He's not adding anything. He actually, it's called a 50% reduction. So he just took pieces away. And I don't know, just really fun. Fun is what I need right now as I secure apartments and such.
Yeah.
This is Miley Cyrus's We Can't Stop remix by Dan Deacon. You can purchase it for $0 or whatever you want to pay at Mabson Enterprises, B as in boy, S-O-N, enterprises.bandcamp.com. Pay what you want. Enjoy.
For Miley, as she was apparently meant to be heard.
Thank you, Jess Gittner. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
I found a lot of things on the convention floor, Comic-Con floor, that were making me happy that I did pick up. One in particular, a book from Chronicle Books called Super Graphic, A Visual Guide to the Comic Book Universe by Tim Leong, L-E-O-N-G. Tim
Leong. I have a copy of that at my desk.
It is wonderful. He is director of digital design at Wired Magazine, if you have even a passing interest in the superhero world. But specifically, if you have an interest in excellent, witty, incredibly attractive infographics and data being conveyed in a really engaging, really striking way, this is such a smart book, such a fun book. I would urge you not to open it up. I would just take my, I have never steered you wrong. Just get this book, because turning the pages and seeing something new and incredibly different take on this approach every single page is just a unalloyed delight. It is great. It's called Super Graphic. I can't recommend it highly enough. This book made me very, very happy.
Wonderful. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
Well, as mentioned earlier, I am going this weekend to the Newport Folk Festival in Newport, Rhode Island. I have found in past years of going to the Newport Folk Festival that in addition to the wonderful music there, the place is not swarming, but in attendance are a number of lovely, lovely Pop Culture Happy Hour listeners who I've had a wonderful time meeting people who listen to the show. If you see me there, I will be around. Please say hello. As I mentioned earlier, that festival really is just, it's in this gorgeous spot where you have ocean on one side and these ruins behind you, and it's just a perfect place to see music performed. Also, a couple of things that have appeared on our website written by people in this room. Glenn Weldon blogging about the San Diego Comic-Con and reading extensive discussions of his interactions with my mother was kind of surreal and wonderful, and that is a perfect meeting of the minds.
Thanks.
And I really want to call attention, if you have not already seen it, to an essay by Ms. Linda Holmes.
Yep.
And I'm sure Linda saw me going there when I mentioned things written by people in this room. But if you have not read Hey Kid, Thoughts for the Young Oddballs We Need So Badly, if you have children, if you don't have children, it is just an incredibly inspiring sort of open letter to weirdos everywhere that is, boy, I just loved it.
Also, if you're an adult...
Yeah, if you're exactly, and I know Linda that you got an email from your father about that piece that said proud to know you.
I did,
and I felt exactly the same way.
I did. Thank you, buddy. Well, it's interesting that you had mentioned that essay, because the first thing making me happy this week is that I got a really lovely comment on that essay from a young woman whose name is Azure, and she's 13, and she is an animator. And she posts her animations on YouTube, and she left a lovely comment that sort of said, this was really inspiring and helpful to me. You know, I put my animations on YouTube and I never know how people are going to feel about them. And I did a One Direction parody, and that sometimes the most popular things are not the best things. I did a One Direction satire, which is true, she did. And that got the most views, but I know it's not my best work. And and so I just feel like I have to continue doing what means something to me.
This is a thoughtful 13-year-old.
So I go to YouTube. I go to YouTube and I start poking around in her stuff. And it's just, it's wonderful. It's really, she's young. She's 13. She's not making like Michel Gondry, you know, movies. But there is tremendous imagination. Mm. There's tremendously idiosyncratic thinking. And it was just thrilling to me. And for her to say, like, this really inspired me. It made me feel good and all this stuff. I thought, well, that's my month basically made valid. So thanks to her, and check out her stuff. I'm going to link to it because it's really, really fun to watch.
Nice.
That's the first thing making me happy this week. And then I feel like, although it's not making me happy this week, the other thing obviously that I want to talk about is that Jess is taking off for St. Louis, which she talked about last week. But as many of you know, we started this podcast with our esteemed producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katzeff. And when Mike was leaving, the conversation that Stephen and I had first was, is there still a show?
Yeah.
And we said, how is there still a show when Mike leaves? Which, of course, at one level just tells you how highly we revered Mike. And Mike really was the one who handpicked Jess to come and do the show with us. And I, as the person who hosts the show, rely very heavily on the person who produces the show to sort of think of things that I don't notice, either while we're in the room or later in production. And Jess has the same quality that Mike had, in that if I'm concerned about something, there's an excellent chance that by the time I hear the cut of the show, it'll be gone.
Yep.
By the time I hear
the show.
I had
that happen just last week.
So I just really wanted to express tremendous gratitude to Jess for stepping in a way to an even harder job than Mike had, because the show did already have its own personality and feel. And, you know, Jess has been so helpful to us and made it possible for us to continue to do the show, which means so much to us. And I really do not know what would have happened upon Mike's departure. And I think now that we've done it with a couple different producers, we're a little more capable of figuring out where to go from here. The show will go on.
We will not value the next producer.
Right. The next one, they're dropping in importance all the time. But I think getting through that first transition away from the person with whom we started the show is an extremely important transition. And we're just extraordinarily grateful. Of course, we're also extremely grateful to Jess for being on the show, for being the lesbian canon.
That's your derby name.
Yeah, it's a good derby name.
A lot of people have expressed to us how much they appreciate many different things about Jess's viewpoint. Not only that she's the lesbian canon, but also that she's the, you know, the under 30 canon and a bunch of other things. So I just personally wanted to just thank Jess again and just mention how much we appreciate it and how much we will miss her.
Oh, shucks.
Yep.
So
co-signed.
So yeah,
I don't do warmth. Co-signed.
Not making me happy this week, but making me grateful this week. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn at GHWeldon, WELDON. You can follow Jess as she goes off to the Midwest and has her wonderful adventures at Jess Gittner, GITNER. You can follow our absent pal, Trey Graham, at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katzeff, at Mike Katzeff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks again to Jess, and thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.